Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Black Hills State University hosts Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon tomorrow night. His visit is part of a year-long series of events led by the South Dakota Humanities Council. It coincides with the centennial of the Pulitzer Prize. Michael Chabon won the Pulitzer in 2001 for the novel The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. His latest novel is released in late November from HarperCollins. It's called Moonglow. You can pre-order it today. Chabon speaks on the topic Thanks, Teach, Remembering Four Writing Mentors this Wednesday, 7 p.m. at the Student Union at Black Hills State. But first, he joins us from Berkeley, California via phone. Michael Chabon, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Oh, thanks, Laurie. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, you could speak about anything that you chose, really, at this point in your career, and you've chosen to talk about writing mentors, and I'm wondering why.
Well, I guess I found myself thinking more. The older I get, the longer I write, and I suppose, to be honest, more of the people who have been important to me were important to me when I was young, the teachers, start to, frankly, die. As each one kind of goes, I found myself sort of reflecting a little more about just my relationship with that individual teacher and then with teachers generally. And, I think the older you get, maybe too, the more you realize how much of the credit for what you've done, what you've accomplished in your life is due to other people, not yourself, and in particular, if you've been fortunate, like I have, to the teachers that you've encountered along the way.
Mentorship must have many different looks and many different possibilities, from an author that you never meet to somebody who works with you very closely. Give me an idea of what mentorship as a writer has looked like for you in your career.
Well, it has definitely taken, I think the form, if you were to define other writers that you encounter only in books, only through their work and in no other way, the writers who have an influence on you, whose books make a strong impression on you, either when you're young or at any point throughout your life, who in some way or another become your masters. I think that's the more common sort of mentorship that gets talked about by writers, although it usually doesn't get put under that that term, probably because in a way it's such a one-sided, it's really the decision of the, to use the word mentee, it always feels a little weird. Right. You're talking about like toothpaste or something, mentee fresh, but it's one-sided. It's up to you. You decide, oh, Henry James is my mentor, but Henry James didn't really have a whole lot to say in the matter. I think we're familiar with that, and writers write and speak all the time about the influence of various other writers on their work. And then writers, you do meet writers outside of the context of a formal teaching program who become mentors for you. And then, of course, there could be other people who aren't writers at all who are mentors in one way or another to help shape your career as a writer. In this talk, I'm really going to be focusing pretty purely on actual teachers, people who, were either a high school, or actually a junior high school teacher of mine, and then teachers that I had in college and graduate school. These are just sort of in the way, almost like remembrances of them and the kind of the way they were, in a sense, and how the way they spoke about writing influenced me.
They sort of live in your mind forever. I could start listing mine as well. I think anybody listening could probably start listening or start making a list on their own.
Absolutely. And I hasten to add, one of the people I'm going to be talking about, I don't know whether she is alive or dead. I haven't been able to figure that out yet. That was the one from when I was in junior high. And then the others, one is still very much alive, but the others have all passed on.
What is the role of reading in your life today? I know it's important for you from such a young age, but what kind of reader are you now?
I don't actually get to read anywhere near as much as I would like to, which is a function of, unfortunately, of my writing habits. I work at night, And I usually start work around between 10 and 11 p.m. and usually work till somewhere between 4 and 5 a.m. Which means, I mean, that's sort of typically prime reading time. And when on nights when I'm not working, if I take off a weekend night or two, even sometimes, you know, I'll get in bed and read for a few hours. I can't, for some reason, bring myself to take time in the middle of a day, even if I've gotten my work done the night before and I plan to get it done again tonight. Somehow, there's just so much to be done in the daytime in terms of, you know, my kids and managerial type things to take care of in terms of emails and such. But it, just to sit down in the middle of the day with a book and read for an hour feels somehow illicit. not to say that I don't do it sometimes. My reading is often guided, the reading that I do is often guided by what I'm working on. So I will, I might be reading works of nonfiction that in some way are sort of helping me research or create a certain kind of milieu in whatever fictional project I'm working on. Or else I'll read writers whose work, I'll read books that I feel like are somehow or another addressing a similar kind of technical problem to the one I'm trying to address, whether it's a question of a tricky point of view or trying to cover the passage of time, a long sweep of time in a relatively short space, or things like that, just to see how other writers have solved some kind of technical problem. Or else I'm typically rereading a favorite book. I'm a big rereader. I don't really add that many new books to my repertoire, and usually only because my wife, who's voracious and reads everything, tells me I have to.
Are there any technical problems that still stump you? Or have you solved them all at this point? Because you are unafraid.
Are there any technical problems that don't stump me? It doesn't ever get any easier. And I've been doing this professionally for something like 30 years now, and I still make the same kind of rookie mistakes all the time.
Nobody wants to hear that.
You don't notice you're making them a lot of the time. I think it helps. My experience tends to help me more when I'm revising my work, when I'm editing my work, when I sit down and look at what I've kind of cranked out, and then I'll start to see, okay, no, you need to do this, you need to do that. When I put the editor hat on, then my experience and my knowledge comes more into play. But especially when you're trying to generate first draft material, at least when I'm trying to generate first draft material, I know so little about about these characters and the world they live in, and what's going to happen to them. And there's a fairly long process of discovery that has to take place. And I'm just groping along in the dark to such a degree that to also be trying to figure out, okay, no, what's the right point of view here, or how can I structure these chapters so that the flow of time is somehow seamless and invisible to the reader, but actually we're leaping across three decades or whatever it might be. I think it's just more than I can handle all at once. So, the most common one is something you're taught very early, which is you write in scene. You don't do summary, dramatize the action of the book. But which means essentially in a way it's like you're sort of approximating a play with characters talking, or approximating a screenplay, and you have characters in a situation and they talk to each other and they do things and you present it as it's happening, and you're not just saying summarizing their actions and their words. And that's a very basic thing that you're taught to do, and yet I forget to do it all the time, especially if I'm working really hard trying to sort of establish an atmosphere and setting and give a real sense of where we are and what it feels like and what it smells like and how it sounds and all of those things. Right. I will often start to feel this horrible sense of discontent, and then I look back over the last 25 pages and I realize I have yet to write a scene, I have yet to write a line of dialogue.
Wow. So, I would not have guessed that. Have you learned to trust that process now at this point? Do you trust?
I have no choice. I do. I mean, it's not that I even trust it or don't trust it. It's just, it is what it is. And I write the way I write. It's very wasteful. It's very inefficient. If I could plot things out really carefully ahead of time, I would save myself so much time and effort. There would be so many fewer dead ends and blind alleys that I wander down and then make, you know, maybe spend 3 months on and then realize that's not going to work. But what I've discovered all over the years is that if I plot things out too much in advance, I lose interest in the why. If I could plot it out so well and know it so well beforehand, then why write it? To me, it's so much about that finding out what happens.
Tell me what it was like to win the Pulitzer Prize for Cavalier and Clay. How did you find out?
You know, I mean, just having you ask that, just hearing that, and thinking back to that moment just puts a smile on my face immediately. It takes me right back. It really, truly was one of the happiest days of my life. It was so, you know, so gratuitous. It was so unexpected and unasked for and you know, it's not, I mean, yes, it was a very happy day when each of my four beautiful children was born. It was a happy day when I married my wife, but, you know, those days are also kind of fraught, and they have their potential for, you know, serious disaster or just minor disaster in the case of a wedding. And, you know, there's anxiety and all the relatives are there and whatever. It's not unalloyed, and you're also exhausted and stressed and tired. But with the prize, it just was this magical thunderbolt that just, you know, I was out back at the studio I work in, it was behind my house, and my wife was in the house, and it was morning, and I was just doing some email or something, and she was 7 months pregnant at the time with our third child, and she started screaming, and I ran in the house thinking something was wrong, and you know, I opened the door, and she's holding the phone, she said, "You won the Pulitzer Prize! You won the Pulitzer Prize!" She started jumping up and down, and you know, leapt into my arms, and somehow I managed to catch all 100x pounds of her, and you know, just we were leaping and jumping, and then suddenly she realized, you know, that she was still on the phone, and the way that you typically traditionally find out is the AP calls you. That they're the traditional notifier. So the AP's literary reporter was on the other line, and you know, she suddenly remembers he's still there. Hillel Atali is his name, and she passed me the phone, and she's like, "Oh my God, oh, he's still here." She hands me the phone, and I say hello, and he says, "I gather you heard." But it was great. You know, my family, many of them live in right around here in the Bay Area, and friends just sort of trickled over to our house all day long and just stayed, and we all sat in the kitchen and celebrated, and we ordered in a lot of Chinese food that night for dinner, and it was just, you know, it was a wonderful day.
That's a good story. You took your son, who wasn't born at that time, to Paris Fashion Week and wrote about it for GQ recently.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that piece so people know to go find that online. And what were you hoping to sort of accomplish by writing about taking him to this Fashion Week?
Well, I mean, the writing was in a way, writing about it was really the means to an end, even though I was a little unclear myself about just what that end would be. But our son, Abe, who's 13, loves clothes. He loves fashion. He's fascinated by us. He has a very strong personal style that he has had in one form or another since the moment he could express, you know, preference for what to wear and what not to wear. I mean, from the time he was a very little kid. And the older he's gotten, sort of the more sure of himself in that way he's become, and the more intense his fascination with, you know, men's fashion has become. And it's on the one hand, it's almost, it's impressive, and it's almost, and sometimes awe-inspiring. And on the other hand, I personally feel like, really, clothes? Like, it couldn't be like microbiology or, you know, or something that actually maybe like you'll grow up to benefit humanity in some way. You know, there's a part of me that sees it as kind of frivolous. At the same time, I have nothing but the most complete respect for him, because I see that it's truly a passion. And it sort of exists independently of, it's not a peer thing by any means. I mean, boys typically, you know, his friends don't dress anything like he does. They just wear, you know, athletic clothes and jeans like everybody else. And they, you know, it's something that exists in him, of him, because of him. And he, you know, that is amazing to me. So I guess I just sort of, in a way, I wanted to understand better and see, and also give him the opportunity to really explore this passion. And so, you know, I knew about Men's Fashion Week. I knew it was happening in Paris. He has a bar, he had a bar mitzvah this year in March, and, you know, there's always a question of, like, what to give your kid as a bar mitzvah present. And so, but I, you know, that's an expensive proposition, going to Paris and taking your kid to Paris. So I approached GQ Magazine to see if they might be interested in sending us, and then I would report on it for them and write about him and to see what came of it.
The ending of that piece, I won't even lead people down through the piece. Go find the issue of GQ or look it up online. It's so artfully and delicately rendered that I don't think we could do it justice. So
if you're just joining us,
you've been listening to best-selling author, Pulitzer Prize winner, Michael Chabon. His novel, Moonglow, was released in late November. He's speaking tomorrow night at Black Hills State University. Michael, thank you so much for your time today. You've been
Lori, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
We'll see you soon. Welcome to South Dakota when you get here.
Thank you.